Good morning, everyone. It's kind of like a quiet Sunday morning, doesn't it? We who have lost our sense and our senses, our touch, our smell, our vision of who we are, we who frantically force and press all things without rest for body or spirit, hurting our earth and injuring ourselves, we call a halt. We want to rest. We need to rest and allow the earth to rest. We need to reflect and to rediscover the mystery that lives in us, that is the ground of every unique expression of life, the source of the fascination that calls all things to communion. We declare a Sabbath, a space of quiet, for simply being and letting be, for recovering the great forgotten truths, for learning how to live again. That is from the UN Environmental Sabbath Program. And I hadn't selected it ahead of time. I was looking through my book a little more and I spotted it. I had read it years, some time ago. And so I haven't Googled the UN Environmental Sabbath Program yet. I will, because I'm curious about it. Like, what was it? How was it formed? What did it, But I really like what it says, because we have no days of rest in our culture anymore. It's relentless. 24/7, right? On Sundays, one spouse goes for an early shift at the hospital and the other spouse goes for a late shift at Walmart. And there's no time to sit down and eat together as a family or prepare food together. And that's really harming our society, really harming our society, that 24/7 relentless push with no rest, with no Sabbath, with no time to spend non-driven time together as a family, or with a friend, or with a spouse, just with a spouse, or just with yourself, to give yourself even a half day. It seems almost impossible of non-driven time, off the to-do list. Yeah. You can even have a Zen to-do list, believe me. ironic as that is. Yeah. So we give ourselves a Sabbath when we come and sit in quiet together. We give ourselves a Sabbath even if we sit down for half an hour at home and sit quietly. We give ourselves a Sabbath even if we sit and have a cup of tea and a snack without multitasking, without some kind of noise other, like earbuds in our ears or... Yeah. So we can give ourselves mini Sabbaths. And that's good too. And a walk in the woods is a really good Sabbath, as you may be discovering here. So as I mentioned yesterday, there are many aspects we could explore in our relationship of body and earth. But the one I'm going to choose for this last morning is movement. Animal life is characterized by movement, right? Mostly self-propelled. But that we can't use that as a firm boundary, because there are plants that turn to face the sun, and there are carnivorous plants that close their spiny mouths on little flies and digest them. Have you ever watched a Venus flytrap? Close. And then there are animals that look like plants, clinging to the tidal tidal zone rocks and swaying in the waves. I'm just going to read you a bit from Andrea Olson on movement. Movement partners the dynamics of the earth. Momentum, centrifugal force, and gravity inform the way we swing an arm. You know, we do that with gravity and centrifugal force, like the laws of matter. The way we turn our head or leap across a stream. In many ways, the moving body is our connection to the family of things. Rather than creating movement, we participate in the inherent movement of the planet. Physicality encourages an embodied experience of place. You can't, for example, slide to the ground and be other than where you are. Motion requires your immediate attention. Or are you fresh at times? Yet intention is sometimes unclear. As we seek critical praise and approval, we can begin to consider a strong or flexible body as the goal, rather than the process through which we connect to the larger forces of life. The body being a process through which we connect to the larger forces of life. We can trace a growing bias against the intelligence of the body in Western cultures for the past 2,000 years. Gradual institutionalization of religion, medicine, and education has left physical intelligence and creativity suspect. Trust in our own inner processes in particular has been discouraged, right, in favor of rational cognitive knowledge. This distancing of ourselves from ourselves is in part responsible for the split of self from other and of humans from the larger dance of the cosmos. It is as though by denying awareness of our earthly form, our moving body, we avoid what's called, she has quotes, evil. And what she's not saying, that earthly form, that sensuous moving body is often identified as female. And jeopardizing of spiritual, attainment. Come back to that. She says, that theory has proven disastrously inadequate. Instead, it's time to revitalize our awareness of what it means to be human in all our dimensions and to make choices accordingly. To engage the challenges of the environmental crisis, we need our full selves present, our physical, emotional, intuitive, thinking, sensual, and spiritual selves. The whole package of what makes us alive. Movement occurs in the context of planet Earth. Our bodies are formed and informed through our relationship to this unique environment of gravity, geomagnetic fields, radiation, and air pressure. We push our weight down into the Earth to take a step forward. We lever against the ground in order to reach or to turn around. If you try doing these things on a slick, icy surface, you realize how much that contact is necessary for our movement. The gesture, the simple gesture of opening a door, engages muscles throughout the body. Some to stabilize, some to mobilize. Movements register the qualitative tone of an experience, whether we are anxious, joyful, tentative, or bold, whether a place is threatening, pleasurable, mysterious, or enlivening. Where there is life, there is movement. And as humans, we are walkers. Right? We're runners, swimmers, jumpers, dancers, climbers, divers, riders of horses and bicycles, and drivers of many kinds of vehicles. We like to be on the move, right? For many people, it's hard to stay still for long. It's how we interact with the earth we live on. It's how we find food. It's how we live in social groups through movement. One of my favorite writers, Rebecca Solnit. Anybody know her work? If you do, if you don't, check it out. Check her out. She's brilliant and a very integrative thinker and writer. She wrote a book, one of her earlier books is called Wanderlust, A History of Walking. And in her introduction, she says that walking, I'm quoting, can be invested with wildly different cultural meanings, from the erotic to the spiritual, from the revolutionary to the artistic. So she's saying we can walk seductively or contemplatively or politically. Often that's called a march, right? Or artistically, we can make our walk a dance. But ideally, she says, walking is a state in which the mind, the body, and the world are aligned, as though they were three characters finally in conversation together, three notes suddenly making a chord. Walking allows us to be in our bodies and in the world without being made busy by them. To be in our bodies and the world without being made busy by them. Can we walk that way? This is, I think, why walking meditation is such an important part of our practice. Because it helps us, trains us to be in our bodies and in the world without being busy. And likewise, doing work with our hands, work practice. You know, in a longer Zen retreat, if we were doing the cooking, right, we'd be chopping carrots, or we're sweeping, or ringing bells. All those things are helping us be in our bodies and in the world, connecting without being busy. Rebecca Solnit says, walking shares with making and working that crucial element of engagement of the body and mind with the world, of knowing the world through the body and the body through the world. Just doing each thing, fully engaged and awake. No other animal, as we said yesterday, walks upright like we do with hands free to manipulate the material world in ever more sophisticated ways. Solnit quotes an anthropologist named John Napier, who was one of the first to claim that upright walking came earlier in human evolution than was previously believed. And he says, human walking is a unique activity during which the body, step by step, teeters on the edge of catastrophe. Our bipedal mode of walking seems potentially catastrophic because only the rhythmic forward movement of first one leg and then the other keeps us from falling flat on our face. You can feel that. If you slow down your walking, you feel that sort of balance, tipping, 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 and then you take the step. You can observe it most easily in toddlers, right? Because the many aspects, those small movements that unite for smooth walking, they're still learning them. So you can see how they kind of lean forward, right? And then they rush the little legs to keep up. And then sometimes they just tumble over because they didn't quite get the coordination and they get frustrated. But they master the art. They master the art of walking. What a miracle, walking upright. Most of us don't remember what that felt like. Do anybody remember what it felt like, you know, to take your first steps? I don't. But those who have had to learn to walk again in adulthood after an injury or a stroke, must, I think, have that feeling of, you know, that potentially catastrophic process of taking each step. Yeah. Then there's dance. Toddlers dance naturally when they hear dancing music, don't they? Have you ever seen them? Start bouncing. I have a friend who used to play in a swing band, and they busked on weekends at Granville Island. And the toddlers, they love the swing music. They just gravitate. It was like a magnet. And they just start dancing. It's very cute. How many of you loved dancing as little girls? Was there, and some of you may have continued quite a ways, but was there a point where it changed and it wasn't just that love of dancing and it became performance and where attention entered in? Did anyone have that experience of the change? My mom said that to me once. She said, "You used to just dance around as a little girl." And then they had those ballet and tap lessons at school, and you went, and then you stopped dancing. Because it was all prissy and I didn't want to dance in a prissy way. They should have had a different kind back then, but they didn't. Yeah, and some of us, that changes with how we feel about our bodies, you know, how we feel about dancing as we get older. But dancing must be as old as human beings. Older, right? Birds. Birds are really good dancers. You ever watch birds do their little courtship dances? Loons, have you ever watched loons do their courtship dance on water? Some of our earliest dances were probably imitating them. And then we put on some feathers, you know, so we'd look like them, a little more like them. And we, like birds, dance to attract a mate. But we also dance to attract the attention of the gods, to petition them for rain or freedom from illness or to thank them. And we dance for the joy of movement and for healing and for transcendence of the small, tight self. Dancing, we could say, is expressive, communicative movement. Or movement that's also made sort of stylized so that we can see the beauty in it more. It uses the rhythms and movements that are all around us in nature and in our bodies themselves, the natural movements and rhythms. What could be more natural than the gesture of the language of gesture? Right? Dance is the language of gesture. Buddhist monks, taking the traditional full Vinaya vows of old and still today, have to renounce dancing or viewing dancing. Why do you think?
I don't think it's right.
No, but why do you think that is? That monks are not supposed to dance or see dancing?
Sexualization. Yeah. Being sexualized.
Yeah, because it arouses sensual desire, right? Trouble with that is mostly what that meant was the desire for women's bodies. So that in early Buddhism, as in other religions, there's a streak of body hatred that's often directed at women's bodies as objects. to, I mean, there's a meditation in the early suttas of visualizing voluptuous women aging and decaying. And it's supposed to induce a feeling of loathing to dampen the flames of passion in young men. Certainly women would not have invented such a meditation. And and I, you know, most women, at least in this culture, it's culture I know best, have enough trouble with having a friendly relationship towards our body without having to cultivate loathing for it. So I think we need to look with a kind of deconstructive eye at some of the tradition, and to recast desire or attachment or non-attachment in a way that doesn't feed aversion to this body, which is the vehicle for our awakening. And and there are other sources in the tradition that affirm that. That we must care for our bodies, because we are in the human realm, and this is the realm where we are best able to see into the nature of suffering and freedom from suffering, to awaken. So I think that we can maybe reclaim dance in our practice and movement, and to make contemplative movement a part of our practice. Why not? And for us to make it an offering, in the same way that we offer our voices in chant, or our words in poetry, or the work of our hands in visual art. There's a place for all that in our practice. And so there's a place for movement too. When we take up all these expressive practices, for lack of a better thing to call them, we exercise our capacity for offering up and giving away. Right? It's a practice of generosity, of not withholding, for all the reasons that we do hold back out of fear or shame, you know, fear of criticism. Instead, we just offer up. Just this moment's offering, you know. Offering up becomes a template for the way we can live our everyday lives. As an act of generosity. That doesn't mean we have to be all perfect. In fact, we can offer up our imperfection. We can even offer up our blunders and our lapses. We can say, oh, I wasn't paying attention. Or, oh, I didn't see that as clearly as I could. I see the causes and conditions that led to what I did. And I renew my aspiration, I renew my vows to be awake and to be of benefit to all. And you offer that up. You offer up your messes like compost. I'm going to read you a poem by Wendell Berry. At the start of spring, I open a trench in the ground. I put into it the winter's accumulation of paper, pages I do not want to read again, useless words, fragments, errors, and I put into it the contents of the outhouse, light of the sun, growth of the ground, finished with one of their journeys, To the sky, to the wind, and then to the faithful trees, I confess my sins, that I have not been happy enough, considering my good luck, have listened to too much noise, have been inattentive to wonders, have lusted after praise. And then, upon the gathered refuse of mind and body, I close the trench, folding shut again the dark, the deathless earth. Beneath that seal, the old escapes into the new. So we can offer up our mess and make compost of it, and the earth will receive it and make new. Moving the body with senses open, with awareness, is an excellent way of releasing inheld hurts and grievances and anxieties. Sometimes sitting, when you're holding just so much, sometimes sitting is hard, and then it's really important to move the body, be outdoors. Detox. That's what we do. Movement and stillness are paired, like light and darkness. Right? Life and death, movement and stillness. You can't have one without the other. So let's bring that mind of Zazen into our movement and join the dance. The 17th century Japanese Zen master Hakuin Zenji says this in his Song of Zazen, which we chant sometimes at the Zendo. With form that is no form, going and coming, we are never astray. With thought that is no thought, even singing and dancing are the voice of the Dharma. How boundless and free is the sky of samadhi. How bright the full moon of wisdom. Truly, is anything missing now? Nirvana is right here before our eyes. This very place is the lotus land. This very body, the Buddha. So I'll stop there and I'll ask you to stand up.